Welcome to episode 158 of Speaking of Mysteries. I'm Nancy Clare, and my guest for this podcast is Matthew Quirk, whose new thriller, The Night Agent, tells the story of Peter Sutherland, a young FBI agent with something to prove, who's given a job manning the night desk in the White House's Situation Room. Sutherland's national security assignment could best be described as extremely boring if there wasn't a specter of catastrophe hanging over the whole endeavor. His job is to sit through the night hours by a phone that everyone hopes never rings, but be ready to act should it happen. As soon as the phone does ring, Sutherland jumps in, but the waters are rougher than he or anyone else expect. Here's Matthew Quirk to talk about The Night Agent. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. This is Nancy Clare, and today on the show we have Matthew Quirk, whose The Night Agent has just been published. Welcome, Matt.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I really enjoyed your book, and one of the beauties of this podcast is I get to talk to people whose books I really enjoy. One of the things that I like so much was your protagonist, Peter Sutherland. He has an incredibly unique perspective on national security, which is anything but a 9-to-5 pursuit. He mans the night desk in the White House Situation Room. And I was wondering, what attracted you to that choice for him? Why did you put him there?
Well, that's a fun story because I was a reporter in D.C. for The Atlantic, and I had a friend who had a very similar national security job. And he didn't talk about it much. We just knew he worked for the FBI and that he would disappear every night and people would whisper about it. And I got into my head that he did basically what Peter does every night, which is kind of sits by a phone waiting for a crisis and if need be waking up the most powerful people in government. And I just thought that was so cool and dramatic that I filed it away. And I mentioned it to my agent and some other writer friends, and they said, go write that. So I did. And it was fun. I got to go talk to my friend who had that overnight job and find out exactly what he was doing. And it was extremely interesting. And so I dove in, and the role in the book is very similar to watch officers that work in the Situation Room. And, for reasons that become very clear in the book, Peter Sutherland, the protagonist, has a very special job on the watch in the Situation Room.
And he's also, Peter's also a man with something to prove, which makes him vulnerable to overachieving and what I consider overachieving's close relative second guessing. I thought you did a great job working that into his character without making him in any way annoying.
Oh, good. Yeah. It was funny because I read and love tons of espionage thrillers. And in books and TV and movies, often you have a loose cannon, and as soon as you tell them to do something, you know they'll do the opposite. But if you spend a lot of time in D.C., you learn that most people in national security are very by the book. They're selected to, not have things that would get in the way of getting a clearance. So they tend to be a little square. And that was kind of the starting point to think, why would he be so by the book and such a straight arrow? And how could you make that sort of an interesting character development? And you say, well, what if it's because his father was always under suspicion of being a spy? And then what happens if you sort of force him to become everything he's worked so hard to avoid and face up to his greatest fears and to sort of have to cross those lines he's respected his whole life. So he was a fun character for me, and it was fun to work in a lot of kind of real life stuff about people who work these secret jobs in D.C.
I know. It's the idea that he's the guy that you see on the train and you sit next to him at Starbucks, stand in line with him at CVS, and you have no idea. He's not wearing a tuxedo with a bow tie.
Yeah, you want, an intelligence officer, you want to be completely unexceptional.
And I more of a Le Carré kind of intelligence officer than Ian Fleming, probably.
Yeah, that's always the tension. When I go to D.C. and I talk to friends and I say, well, what should I write about? They'll say, oh, people have been accepting the wrong format of PDFs at the FISA court. And I'm like, that's not a good thriller. But, you know, you don't want to have people flying helicopters through metro tunnels, although that's cool in the Mission Impossible movies. So that's the fun balance to make it feel very real, but also make it very dramatic.
I'm going to come back to that idea of the helicopter through the metro tunnel in just a second. But I wanted to ask you about Rose Larkin, because I also liked her a great deal. And she's a very capable young woman in spite of her work resume. And I think that that's a very important point, especially for a woman. Just because she's not a superstar in her career doesn't mean she's not capable and even extraordinary individual.
Yeah, I mean, what's fun in these is to have more of an everyman, and the furrow I'm plowing with these books now is Washington characters who are kind of real people whose jobs I learned about and who I know and who have these really neat jobs like night watch officer. And so they're sort of everyman and women. And it's nice to have ways into the story where everyone isn't like an invincible superhero. So, you know, Peter he's extraordinary in many ways, but he's ordinary in many ways. And Rose is, you know, she could be you or I. So, it's great to have characters like that, because I think that really brings home the tension and, excitement of being plunged into a mystery and, some espionage affair over your head, which is the, you know, what I love about these, like things like the 39 Steps or, North by Northwest, where you just dropped into the deep end and you have no idea what's going on.
Or as the Michael Mann analogy, you've put your tripod in the middle of the stream.
Oh, I've never heard that before. I like that.
Yeah, that supposedly that's what he said about the Last of the Mohicans.
Oh, yeah. God, that's a great movie.
That he started by sticking his tripod in the middle of the stream and just shooting. And I've always thought that's a great way to get into a story. And you... your story is a bit of a slow boil, but it's definitely a boil. You know, you kind of have no idea what's going on until you do, and then it's sort of a, oh my God, which gets me to the helicopter through the metro tunnels, which you did not use. We should be really clear. There are no helicopters going through the metro tunnels. But what you do is you use Peter Sutherland's local knowledge, which comes in very, very handy when he's driving around sort of the greater Washington, D.C. metro area.
Well, it's fun for me. And I, you know, I moved to Washington when I was 21 or 22. And I was I'd studied literature in college. I didn't know anything about politics and foreign affairs. And then I was really fortunate to get a job at The Atlantic. So I was just thrown into the deep end, and I love DC. It's very green. It's very easy to get around. I would bike everywhere, and there's intrigue everywhere. You know, you would walk past the Iraqi embassy and the Egyptian embassy and the place that there was a car bombing in DuPont Circle in the 70s. It's really fun for me to go back to that time in my 20s when I was just kind of the kid with the nose up against the glass of all these embassies and cool buildings, and was allowed to, you know, go behind the curtain in some places. And it's just really nice to be able to go back there and live in that world.
I know. I think Washington, D.C. is incredibly atmospheric, and you're right. You know, you're walking along and on these alphabet streets, and you have, you know, people are talking, leaning their heads in, talking to each other, and they could be exchanging any number of things from, you know, what they think the wizards are going to do that night to, you know, state secrets. So you're right. It's very cool.
Yeah. And I should mention, you know, there's a scene let's see, not to spoil anything. So there's a sort of high point in the book where that takes place in a hotel near DuPont Circle. And that was a couple blocks from my house. And I used to, you know, sit at the Starbucks there and write. And that hotel, I think in 2015, a man died there under mysterious circumstances. He was a Russian. And it later came to appear that he was, you know, beaten to death by GRU thugs, allegedly, and BuzzFeed has done great reporting. So it's just wild to be doing your, you know, your mundane DC stuff. It's a very buttoned up city, but to know that there's all kinds of, you know, even murder happening around you. So
nefarious stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you know, you sort of anticipated my next question in a way, because I know about the life cycle of a book, and I'm guessing you started to write The Night Agent in 2015 or 2016. Mm-hmm. And so I have to ask you, and this is a completely unironic question, by the way, why did you choose the infiltration of the White House by a hostile foreign power, Russia, at that, for the story? Completely unironic.
Yeah, well, I started in mid-2016, and there were glimmers of Russian meddling in politics, but they were very, compared to today, super under the radar. And so that's
we could call them mirage-like glimmers.
Yeah, I mean, there were bits and pieces that would come out, but they were sort of isolated. And, you know, that's the sweet spot for when you're writing a thriller of, oh, I'll spin this really intriguing one-day article into a whole conspiracy plot. But it's so wild, it could never happen. And what happened was a lot of the directions I had been thinking with the grand, you know, thriller over-the-top conspiracy turned out to be very close to the truth, or, you know, what's being investigated as a possibility now. So that's great. But this book also took a while to write, and you know, it worked out really well. But I wrote it on spec, and we landed with a great publisher. But it was a long time of gestating, so it actually worked out really well because I saw where the news was going, and I saw that my plot was actually a little too close to the truth. And then I got to step back and think about how to future-proof it and how to play off of what was happening in a way that would still be surprising. And I think it made the twists hopefully more twisty, because I was able to play off of where things were going. And I really liked the way that worked out, because instead of just being sort of a sensationalization or playing forward a scandal that everyone's paying attention to, it moved and has some zigs and zags that I think people aren't expecting. So it all worked out really well, but there were a bunch of white knuckle moments when I was writing it.
Well, you're absolutely right. And we should mention that the occupant of the Oval Office in your book bears no similarities to the current occupant. So this is not a read from the headlines in that regard. And we shall say no more about...
Yeah, because I didn't want it to be, you know, just a fictionalized Romana Clef about the president, you know, and those end up being dated. So it all worked out. I got what I needed just in time at every point. But there was definitely some scary moments when I was right.
But I thought it was a good story, and as you said, you know, these days you can't approach a publisher with an idea that's too out. It's almost impossible to approach a publisher with an idea of an espionage novel that's too outlandish. It's just not possible anymore. And so the trick, I would think, not being an espionage writer, is to make it fresh and believable, and yet, even though your readers are suspending disbelief, that it's still a fun ride.
Yeah, it's a tough balance, because people want shocks and twists and turns, But in thrillers, it has to feel very real and very plausible. And those are intention. So that's been kind of the hardest work, and I think where I've learned the most in how to navigate that.
Espionage thrillers have come a long way. We mentioned this earlier in the conversation. They have come a long way from the black and white good guy, bad guy construct of, you know, spy versus spy. And I enjoyed the ambiguity of some of the supporting characters. Could you talk a little bit about freelance intelligence brokers? I'm assuming they exist because these days fiction rings truer than truth.
Well, there's just, you know, you never know who anyone's working for. And a false flag, which that term now is associated with like crazy conspiracy theories, but that's basically just where someone like hypothetically Israel approaches you and claims that they're French. And so you never know who you're working for. And, you know, there are also people who are, you know, access agents. That's come out a lot in some of these Trump-Russia real investigations where you have, you know, professors who are, they get paid by different intelligence agencies, but they're not properly officers. So it's a super murky world. And that creates a lot of nice ways in for these sort of thrillers to have a lot of surprises in store.
Have some super murky characters that are neither good nor bad. And that's what I liked about them. They were just people making a living. And granted, the way they made their living was kind of unsavory. But nevertheless, you know, there's a market out there for information, and some of the people in your book have it.
And it's funny, the, you know, hero, black and white versus anti-hero question, because a lot of the TV shows I love, there's been a trend for a long time of anti-heroes. And, Walter White or Tony Soprano, and they're really not, they're doing some really bad stuff. And I found, and I'd be curious to hear what you think, that in thrillers, people actually, they don't want Dudley Do-Right, but it seems like people do like to have a bit more of a good guy. And that's something I've always sort of been fascinated by, and how to strike a balance between having somebody who's complex and also somebody who, you know, makes you feel good. And especially now when politics are so crazy, I think it's nice. And I was glad in this book to have a world I could live in where people were sort of making sacrifices and doing the right thing.
Well, I think the people in our intelligence services do make sacrifices. And I do think the vast majority of them are doing the right thing. I'm not cynical enough to think that they're all tainted in any way. And that's how I felt about Peter, that he was a guy who just found himself in a really tough spot. Rock in a hard space doesn't even begin to describe where he finds himself in the course of this novel.
Yeah. And you know, it's funny, for him, he's, you know, a real straight arrow at the beginning. And, I wanted to scratch at some of his complexity, or, you know, his sort of fears, and his, you know, his father is a suspected spy. But for this book, and I don't know, something about the times right now, it was just really nice to have somebody who was, you know, trying to do the right thing throughout.
Who do you read, and who do you feel influenced your writing? And keep in mind that they might not be the same authors.
Oh, gosh. I mean, recently I've been reading Robert Littell. His CIA book, The Company, is just, I mean, it's incredible. And a ton of Le Carré. I just read his memoir, which was a great...
was amazing. Yeah, it was just amazing.
Yeah, and it was a great way in, because then I read A Perfect Spy, and you realize how autobiographical that is, and what he stole and how he changed it. You know, I love Daniel Silva. I love Lee Child. I love Michael Connelly. What other good? You know, I go back and read the Charles McCarry stuff. He's got a book called The Miernick Dossier, which is kind of an odd book, but yeah, it's great. And I'm trying to think who else. There's so many. I mean, I read all over the place. So, some of the stuff that got me into, I used to read a ton of Evelyn Waugh and sort of loved his, the way in a lot of books, he could go back and forth between satire and very trenchant kind of social world observation. I read a lot, in this espionage thing, and I'm always finding people, but I always feel like I'm kind of criminally underread, and I have I've read one Martin Cruz Smith book and it was amazing. But I need to go back and just cue them all up and go through them.
Well, fortunately although he's had a long career, he's not a fast writer. So you can go back and read some of his books. But I was thinking of some of the ones I've read, lately, and they've included Karen Cleveland, who's a former CIA analyst, and she wrote different but similar kind of book.
Oh, good. Yeah, I have that on my list. I was kind of fascinated by her story.
And Olin Steinhauer, of course, who...
I just read the one where it's kind of the old flames getting back to dinner, all the old knives.
Oh, all the old knives. Yeah, that's, he wrote one recently called The Middleman, which takes place in the United States.
And... I need to start writing things down. This is amazing.
Well, stop by the podcast list and you'll see some. And then I think one of my favorites, I mean, everybody that I talk to is a favorite, but one of my special favorites is, another Olin. It's Robert Olin Butler, who has written a series of espionage agent that takes place at, Europe is already in World War I, and but the United States hasn't entered the war yet, and he's got a character that's an agent working in Europe, and it's just. The time, I think the time is so similar to ours. The parallels, you know, they felt they were on the entry of a technologically revolutionary era, just like we do.
Yeah, and there's so many guys who were in the intelligence services. Like you can go back to Graham Greene, or I might be getting this wrong. I was just doing more homework on stuff to read, but is it Somerset Maugham who was actually a spy?
Yeah.
And then you realize you're getting the real stuff, you know, like Our Man in Havana, which is such a high concept sort of trope that the person has made up all of his Joes, all of his sources. And that happens all the time. And that's based on a real case. And people were going to, you know, the agencies were going to sue him. So there's so much. And I love how much it, the truth and fiction gets mixed up. The Littell is great for that. And I've been reading a ton of memoirs, which are so nice because they're so matter of fact. There's one by a guy named Ishmael Jones. And I read another one called Left of Boom. And it's funny because it's sort of an operations officer and he's such a regular dude. So it doesn't have a lot of the trappings of sort of, classy Harvard and Yale, State Department OSS stuff. And so it was so funny to read an intelligence memoir that was terrific and he did incredible work, but was in the language of just like a regular football guy. Cause there are people like that doing the work. So right. There's, it's a great field to be reading in.
Not everyone's a brainiac. Is The Night Agent a standalone or will we see Peter Sutherland again? And that's a roundabout way of asking you about your next book.
It is planned as a standalone now. I was talking to some TV film people and they were asking, what would a second season be? And I hadn't thought of it. And then I do most of my brainstorming on a walk. So I went for a walk and from the heavens, a whole second arm for Peter and Rose came to me. So I just filed that away and we'll see. But the plan now is I have a few ideas. They're standalones, but they're very closely tied together thematically because there's just a lot of these fascinating jobs like the night agent, that are real DC people, and they have this incredible perspective on power and an ability to kind of pull back the curtain. And so for research for earlier books, I was looking into all this sort of break-in stuff, and there, the government has a lot of people who break in professionally. The FBI has these great teams, and there's these red teams that break into government facilities to test their security. And sometimes we'll even do these dry runs and try to plant dummy bombs in the executive offices of different cabinet agencies. And it's so crazy, but that's a real job. And there's real people being hired to do that at like the CIA, the Department of Defense. So I got to talk to some of these people, and that's kind of the world, and it's another DC book, and it's, a guy gets a job like that, and then he is framed for something, because that's kind of a natural risk of that, and that's the jumping off point. So I finished a draft of that.
And that's sort of like the classic, you think to yourself, you're at a, your kid's soccer game or something, and someone says, so what do you do?
Oh, yeah. And, the DC thing has to be as boring as humanly possible. And it's such a fun game. It's a parlor game to be like, oh, this Canadian cultural attaché, she might be a spy. She doesn't seem that busy. She doesn't seem to be like stressing about emails. But I mean, that's the crazy thing. When you have a real cover, you do the cover job.
I would imagine. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You live the cover. It's not like, you get some business cards and go to work. If you're saying you sell computers, you have to go sell computers.
I read Valerie Plame's book, and that's exactly what she did. She did a cover job.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Matt, for talking to us about The Night Agent. I feel if we go any further, we might start introducing spoilers, and that would be a real shame. Okay.
Yeah.
Because
you gotta keep it.
The book is... The book is, like the blurbs all say, all the blurbs of these books always say that, but this one really is, it was almost too exhausting to read it for me. I couldn't read it at night. I had to read it during the day.
I'm glad it was an ordeal.
No, it was not an ordeal, but it was.
No, but that's what we're going for here in Thriller Town.
Thriller Town, and so cool because it is about the possible infiltration of Russians in the White House, although not what you would expect from what's going on in the news. So thank you very much.
Thank you. This is a pleasure.